Dear sir, how do individual bodies express themselves? In one of your books, I read the following. I suggest that the self is not pure ego, that it is a mere subject. Rather, it is incredibly rich, like a pilot. It observes and takes action at the same time. It is acting and suffering, recalling the past and planning and programming the future, expecting and disposing. It contains quick succession, all at once, wishes, plans, hopes, decisions to act, and a vivid consciousness of being and acting self, a center of action, and that it owes this selfhood largely to interaction, other selves, and with world three. It is almost joyful to read a rich description of the self such as yours. Such a description creates a wonderful sense of blessedness for being in this world and an enormous respect for life itself. In spite of this euphoria, however, it is the final part of the citation, and it owes its selfhood largely to interaction, other selves, and world three, which made me ponder over the question how self, your definition of self, really is. This question does not seem to be a very original one. Theories concerning selves have a long history in social science. And, according to Dorinda Udram, they are loaded with a long history of political connotations. For me, the question is the result of the fact that I could never identify with any of the definitions of self that exist, because I regard the very nature of self as unprecedented. Each life a new life, each self more than a constellation of factors, each generalization of the self as a dislocation for the sake of somebody else. In modern science, it is difficult to follow the idea about uniqueness of selves. The concept of uniqueness does not allow me to control the definition of others, and being a cultural anthropologist, this in turn makes it very hard to call the results of my research, or more accurately my search, to the attention of the public. I am continuously confronted with a certain type of prejudice about the selves of others in non-cultures. In fact, your idea of objective epistemology in connection with the self-realization of individuals makes it almost impossible to refute notions like some cultures tend to have objective epistemological orientations. Such orientations are related to the use of abstract language, individuated self-structures, and lexical mediation of reality. In contrast, other cultures tend to have subjective epistemological orientations. This orientation is related to metaphorical languages, unindividuated self-structures, and imagistic mediation. A citation of an anthropological psychologist. This idea of cultures with individuated self-structure versus cultures with unindividuated self-structures does not allow for a single refutation. Rather, in turn, the concept of objective epistemology usually is not so much a matter of realism, rationalism, or of honest scientific search, as it is a matter of convincing the rest of the scientific world. In cultural anthropology, at least we could establish that part of the history of justification goes hand in hand with the justification of colonialism. It has had, and still does, devastating effects on the cultural knowledge of those cultures which are still considered to be primitive, at least in a lay view. The search about these effects have been centered towards cultures of what is generally known as the other, remote, both in time and space, and, more accurately, the cultures of all these others. The dramatic consequence of scientific justification of frameworks for the existing of individual human beings in the here and now, however, is not a very popular topic. In fact, it is fiercely attacked through the worst connotations as self-serving, navel-staring, solipsism, games concerning the meaning of words, anarchistic and, least but not last, unscientific. Lacking naturalism is sometimes referred to as postmodernism. As a twist of faith, it seems in many theories about modern self and identity in the West, an equally amount of evidence from non-Western culture have furnished ideas to suggest that Western notions of individualism to be fundamentally wrong and ethnocentric. We are still confronted with the fight concerning the naturalism of the Enlightenment philosophy, and the center of these fights still concern questions on whether individuals can or cannot be agent-free from cultural frameworks. The concept of agent-free individuals seems to be highly undesirable, as Charles Taylor writes. Such a person, an agent-free individual, wouldn't know where he stood on issues of importance, would have no orientation in these issues whatever, wouldn't be able to answer for himself on them. If one wants to add to the portrait by saying that the person doesn't suffer this absence of framework as lack, isn't in other words in a crisis at all, then one rather has a picture of a frightening dissociation. In practice, we would see such a person as deeply disturbed. The irony here is that in the case of a deeply disturbed person, the negative qualification Taylor describes are in one and the same breath the alleged causes of the disturbance. We have simply no idea whether disturbance is caused by lack of frameworks. The fact that we are warned against deconstruction and should fear its consequences as a pathological illness is one of this time and not of the Enlightenment. Furthermore, there are feelings, ideas and solutions to problems which, through the impact of their exclusive content, do not ever reach any field of communication and will never gain the status of an objective thought, or a framework, or a counter-framework. The last part of your description on selves, and it owes this selfhood largely to interaction, other selves and with World 3, made me wonder what the rest of yourself consisted of. I must say that I was terrified to see that your idea of a framework mainly focuses on the combination of biological dispositions and virtual external reality, a constructed society, and that you consider individual expression a futile topic for scientific research because it does not really fit in with scientific rationality. It made me trace and deduct the origin of this construction of rationality and view the process which makes rationality to be, against its very nature, so highly seductive, in an almost passionate manner, so passionate that the discourse of rationality seems to be able to rule out all other discourses, and yet, at the same time, it manages to be so fully disembodied and dislocated in both space and time, almost like a drama of two lovers who will never meet on equal terms, but contrary, end up killing each other. I am therefore very interested in your work, dear sir, but not because of its moral truth. It is quite surprising for me that I could not find a motive in any of your work that deal with the topic of individual expression as an important part of democratic participation. In your work The Unended Quest, you shed some light on the views you hold, especially where you write about art and music. You express some interesting views, for of all you mention that Everything a man or an animal can do is, among other things, an expression of an internal state of emotions and of personality. This is trivially true for all kinds of human and animal languages. It holds for the way a man or a lion walks, the way a man coughs or blows his nose, the way a man or a lion may look at you or ignore you. It holds for the way of a bird who builds a nest, a spider constructs its web, and a man building his house. In other words, it is not characteristic for art. For the same reason, expressive or emotive theories are trivial, uninformative, and useless. You know, the least thing you could have done is admitting that these theories are not suitable for testing. But then again, such a view is highly characteristic for your work. Creating one theory and apply it for all of us. I agree. We cannot but express ourselves in so far as we only hold expression linked up to our own bodies. I, being me, would be quite unable to express you, though that is of course still a hypothesis. I also agree that self-expression is not exclusive to art. It could be equally part of any action undertaken by human beings or animals for that matter. I fail to see, however, why this is a reason to declare theories of self-expression in any field to be trivial. This strange triviality has been the topic for centuries of philosophy on the essence of individual beings. It has been of social importance for practically all living human beings, and I wonder if it might be that the triviality of theories of self-expression lies in your view that you label them as unscientific, mythological, and dogmatic. Further grounds for your opinionated ideas on this triviality I found in your remark. Now, throughout my life I have not only believed in the existence of what philosophers call an external world, but I have regarded the opposite view as not worth taking seriously. Strangely enough, I do not disagree with the statement per se, except that your belief in the existence of an external world is as much part of the supposition of, or the opposition to, an internal world. Your view of falsification as a method in science, it seems to me, could neither be seen as apart from any supposed principle of verification. This supposition of the internal world is something you place largely in disciplines and opinions which originate from psychoanalytic theory as well as from linguistic theories. What you seem to have overlooked is the fact that all your theories, true or false, hypotheses or statements, have originated from Western culture in quite a specific form. You've introduced workable forms and methods into a world of knowledge which is as much part of your own external world as anything else. Concepts like objective epistemology or critical rationality would not have emerged without notions of the subjective. I agree that, on the surface, following your thoughts, it seems as if your theory on the validation through falsification would be in agreement with the logic of scientific knowledge, and that this has overthrown concepts derived from subjectification. Subjectivity is formulated in your terms as a dogma, which is pre-scientific, but which we cannot do without, to say the least. The dogma provides us with a frame of coordinates needed for exploring the order of this new unknown and possibly in itself even somewhat chaotic world, and also for creating an order where order is missing. But has it? And what has happened here? Science, I think, is built on an irony of escaping origin. This escapism is characteristic for the quest. Origins cannot be tested scientifically. They escape from scientific definition, they escape from scientific experiments, and even the origin of origin is unknown to science. It marks a dark beginning, which, because of its inaccessibility, is labeled as chaotic and disorganized. Problems concerning the origin of phenomena seem to have been more or less solved in more or less satisfactory ways. But at the same time, these solutions constructed a virtual, formal reality. Problems of origin also are classically connected to problems of the future. This, at the same time, marks the other irony of science, which is that because it concerns itself with an equally unpredictable and inaccessible future, it is labeled equally chaotic, dark, and disorganized as origins. Your work, The Poverty of Historicism, mostly deals with how to and not to entangle problems of origin. In it, you show the merits of experiments within social science. You explain that theories and social science, mostly theories of Marxism, labeled by you as historicism, are dangerous because they maintain a prophecy concerning future social events, and that this prophecy thereby has a tendency to become self-fulfilling. Your reverence happens to concern the remarkable experiments which were applied by Malinowski in the fieldwork environment, and especially his experiments concerning participant observation. Not being able to find the roots of culture, which is quite a dominating problem in anthropology, Malinowski proposed a solution by creating the thought of functionalism. Functionalism, as we know it, basically develops from the idea that if the origins of a society are unknown, one has to seek for the function of its social institutions. The central question is formulated towards the manner in which social institutions dissolve or remain within a society, hence what their function is. Yet, recommendable as this view seems, mainly because of its scientific status, we know now that functionalism is part of a modeling process which creates our views of society as much as it describes them. Science is most notably Western-sized. It can in itself not escape the cultural conditions in which it submerged. As another type of action, Western science seems to be very trapped in the here and now, as much as it is trapped between the body and the mind. How do individuals express themselves? The answer could be that if they do, it is in spite of it all, in spite of an objective epistemology, a truly functional institution that disembodies their own private bodily experiences. So then, what is the object of an objective epistemology?